Tuesday, January 19th, was in many ways the most glamorous of the three great days of the inauguration. In the morning, I had a little visit with several of the house guests and with Nellie and John and their friends. I'd expected to go to the governor's reception alone, but Lyndon decided to go. It was more his staff's urging than mine, so we went together a little after 4 o'clock. The Sheraton Park was a teeming mass of humanity, just like being in the middle of a campaign rally instead of up on the stage at one. We walked from booth to booth, meeting and talking with all the governors. There were, I believe, about 40 there. Probably unexpected, but not the least embarrassing to us, were two southern governors, Wallace of Alabama and Johnson of Mississippi. Wallace told me he hoped I'd come to Alabama soon, and I thanked Governor Johnson again for greeting me at my Biloxi whistle stop. One of the happiest meetings was with Governor Jack Burns of Hawaii and his sweet wife, a polio victim, in her wheelchair. And we were so glad to see Governor Hoff of Vermont and his cute wife, and the Dan Moores of North Carolina, she one of the star orators, the whistle stop trip. Governor Nelson Rockefeller and Happy couldn't have been more affable and charming. We talked about how much we appreciated Lawrence Rockefeller's interest in beautification. Governor Romney and his wife were very friendly also. But it was when we saw the Donald Russells of South Carolina that we had a hugging reunion. John and Nellie were holding court with a crowd of Texans so thick that it was the heaviest traffic in the room. Actually, it was almost frightening to make our way through the crowd. It surged around us so. Governor Hughes, I believe it's of Iowa, was one of the handsomest ones there. And jovial Governor Carvel of Delaware, quite uncrushed in defeat. It was a good hour, and every step of the way, I saw people I knew. That has been the amazing thing about these enormous crowds. How many I know and am really glad to see. When we had circled the hall and emerged into the quiet of the foyer with Phyllis Dillon and Henry Fowler, the co-chairman, it was nearly 6, and the biggest traffic jam you ever saw because of the confluence of the governor's reception crowd, the reception for Hubert Humphrey, and heaven knows what else parties. We decided it was a bit too early to go to Hubert's party, and lucky we did because he was about 45 minutes late to his own party. Back at the White House, Jean-Louis piled my hair up high on my head with the postiche and my American, and I put on the most regal dress I own, or so I think. The American Beauty Red by St. Moore with a bit of a train. If there's any night I dare wear a train, it's to the concert. But the most delightful bit of the day was when I went in Lucy's room trying to rescue Jean-Louis. Lucy's guests are like rabbits. They seem to multiply. That was Betty Beale and Susan Ray, Patty McGuirk, her old Camp Mystic friend. But there were at least 3 or 4 little other girls running around whose names I could not call. All of them squealing, looking for various articles of clothing, telling Jean-Louis to do this and that to their hair. Lucy in a red brocade dress with puff sleeves and an empire waist, just a little $40 dress. That's a sort of 17-year-old Scarlett O'Hara. A delightful mixture of demure Southern belle and sexy flirt was running around the room madly searching for a red ribbon just the right color to put in her hair with the dress. She was holding in her hand a red ribbon that was about twice too wide. Suddenly I heard her say in an almost conversational tone, "Don't come close to me or I'll kill you." It had been a tense and straining several days, but I thought this was going a little far. I said, "Lucy, what on earth?" And then I saw that she was holding in her hand a naked razor blade and was attempting to cut the ribbon in two, while the little girls jostled past her, heading for the closet of the bathroom. We had a light dinner on trays in Lyndon's room, and then we went to the State Department for our reception for the Medal of Freedom winners. This has been one of the best ideas of the whole inaugural, and has added great luster. I think it probably germinated in the brain of Eric Goldman, and it was augmented by a suggestion of Doug Cater's to ask an additional 50 who are prominent in arts and humanities. Writers, painters, composers. When we entered the John Quincy Adams room at the State Department, they were all seated at round tables, but Leonard Marks, their particular host, rose and escorted us around from table to table to meet them. There were 25 of the Medal of Freedom winners out of the possible 56, and I think that's very good considering that many of them are over 80 years old, come from all parts of the United States, and several from overseas. What a room full of brains and talent it was, and their presence added a lot of luster to the inaugural festivities. There was Marian Anderson and Dr. Detlef Bronx, scientist and president of Rockefeller Institution, Ralph Bunche, Nobel Prize winner, diplomat, Aaron Copland, composer of symphonies, lecturer, Pulitzer Prize winner, Dr. Lena Edwards, an obstetrician who gave up a private practice at 60 to set up a clinic for migrant farm workers in the Texas Panhandle. She'd left just hoping that nobody would go into labor because there's nobody to take her place when she's gone. Ellsworth Bunker, ambassador, diplomat. John W. Gardner, educator and author and president of the Carnegie Foundation. Willem de Kooning, painter. Edwin Land, who invented the Polaroid camera. Our friend Ralph McGill, maverick fighter for civil rights in Atlanta. George Meany, A. Philip Randolph, labor leader. Edward Steichen, photographer and artist, who did The Family of Man, and who raises some of the world's finest delphiniums, new strains. I reminded him that he'd promised some to me. George Taylor, arbitrator and educator, who was practically the architect of the railway strike settlement. Handsome Tom Watson, president of IBM. I told him I wanted him to give me a couple of hours of his time sometime soon to explain IBM's philosophy of having everywhere buildings that are so well landscaped and are often on the outskirts of town. And colorful Annie Dodge Wanika, a health worker among the Navajos in her full tribal regalia. And age-defying Dr. Paul Dudley White. We talked about his protege, Willis Hirst, and we asked him to raise up a lot more like him. Andrew Wyeth, one of my favorite artists. I was also glad to see a couple whose names I had added. Tom Lee, artist of El Paso. And to say to him that I was looking forward to the picture that he was going to lend to the White House. And Eric Leinsdorf, director of the Boston Symphony. And many more that I didn't know. The room was beautiful with pink roses. I later found they were those named Speaker Sam, developed by a nursery in Tyler. It was a brief but worthwhile stop. And then we went on to the inaugural concert, arriving in time, but well ahead of a large part of the audience. So we went into an anteroom to wait, being taken around under the wing of Abe Fortas, who introduced us to the performers, his good friend Isaac Stern. I'm much indebted to Isaac Stern for taking Abe out of this world of turmoil into the world of music. It'll make him live longer, and we need him. A tall, straight, boyish-faced Van Cliburn, who was delighted to see Lucy and chatted with her about the music festival. He mentioned something to me about next summer and the possibility of Lucy appearing in something in Washington with him. And then it was time to go in, with considerable pomp and circumstance, to our box, number 13. How that number pursues us through life. Old Constitution Hall was beautiful. The tiers of boxes and balcony railings were festooned with bunting that was star-spangled and striped in red and white and blue color scheme. Our box, Hubert's, were bedecked with red carnations, and every woman who entered had one. Lucy and I were just right in our red dresses. The decorations, I hear, were the work of Mary Lasker, co-chairman of the ball, along with Abe. Lyndon and I and the two girls and Dave sat in our box. And next, we'd asked Mrs. Howard Mitchell, wife of the conductor of the National Symphony, to join us. She was there with the Bobbitts and the Eric Leinsdorfs. We thought this especially fitting for them. And in the next box were the Tony Taylors and the Alexanders. It was a great program, beginning, of course, with the National Anthem, and then Beethoven's Overture to Leonore. And then Isaac Stern, the violinist. And I could just see Abe being transported. Lyndon managed to keep an appropriately interested expression most of the evening. But there was one time when he turned around to talk very interestedly to Linda Bird. Nothing was going on the stage just then, and the audience looked up at us and began applauding us. Lyndon joined loudly in the applause, and then everybody began to laugh, and he saw what he was doing. So he laughed too, and kept right on applauding. And then Van Cliburn strode onto the stage and made us all very proud with a Liszt concerto, in which he showed he was both great artist and considerable actor. During the intermission, I stayed in our box and scanned the audience and saw ever so many people I know. Emily Crow Seldon and Dr. Seldon came up and stood right below me, and we gestured messages back and forth. I saw Aunt Josepha and Aunt Arvelie and Evelyn Ford Spruce out in the crowd, and I thought of the sweet thing Aunt Josepha had said about Lennon's always been mighty good to his old aunties. Warren Lynn was across the way in Mary Lasker's box, having a date with Mary Lasker's nephew, Jim Fordyce. I also saw Albertine, Sam Houston's first wife. After the intermission, Isaac Stern played again, and then there was a medley of songs from Porgy and Bess, one of my favorite light operas, with Todd Duncan, who's been singing it for 30 years and over 1,200 performances, and a beautiful and distinguished-looking young Negro woman named Theresa Coleman. And then, when it was over, came one of the nicest parts. All the audience joined in singing America the Beautiful, and we all felt it. It was the mood everyone was in. It's been the mood of the whole 2 days. Then we went on to the most beautiful party of the inaugural, the only private party we went to, given by Mary Lasker and Abe Fortas at the State Department in honor of the performers at the concert, Isaac Stern and Van Cliburn and Todd Duncan and Theresa Coleman, and having as special guests all of the arts and letters people and the Medal of Freedom winners. It took place in a series of rooms, one for just meeting and talking, one for dancing to Devron, and one where there were round tables with pink tablecloths and the most exquisite pink flowers, and a long buffet loaded with delectable and elegant dishes. And if anybody could possibly tire of the brilliant array of guests, the best-dressed people I saw at the whole inaugural, then you could walk to the window and look out at the equally brilliant view of Washington that spread out below us, one of the loveliest views in the city. Abe took me around, and I got to talk to everybody and found out, oh long arm of circumstance, when I talked to Theresa Coleman, that her musical education had been financed by Charles Marsh, that the dress she had on was a gift of Claudia, and that she was a good friend of Helen Gahagan Douglas. I sat next to Isaac Stern, and we talked about Abe's great love of music and what it did for him. And I saw Wendy Marcus looking quite distinguished. She grows better looking with the years. The most attractive people in town were there, and I could have danced all night. In fact, we did stay about an hour and a half. But it took the press that long to find out we were there. But by the time the flash bulbs began to explode all around us, we said our good nights to the comfortable feeling of second day accomplished with grace and no snow.